Hello, my name is Scott Johnson. This is number 0286, the Stuff File program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0286. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Rick Archbold, who is the author of A Flag for Canada, which states the story of the maple leaf, which this week celebrates its 50th year. There was hot debate when choosing a flag, but for the most part, people do like it now.
You'll still find a few pockets of resistance. One spot where I got a kind of dismissive remark about the maple leaf flag was, interestingly enough, at the Diefenbaker Archives in Saskatoon. But you'd be hard-pressed to find a person today who doesn't just think that that's my flag and that's all there is to it. I do think occasionally maybe there are a few people, I don't know if you ever have driven around Muskoka on Canada Day, but I'm sure I've seen an Ontario Red Ensign flying above a maple leaf flag. Maybe a slight political comment.
Mark O'Connell is an artist, animator, and film reviewer in the UK. He also does caricatures.
I've always enjoyed in my spare time, even from when I was very little, just, you know, looking at someone maybe on TV or someone eating a sandwich somewhere and, you know, just drawing them and coming up with my interpretation of what they might look like. And so I've continued that through now, and I get commissioned to do caricatures for people's weddings or family portraits, all that kind of thing. So I get quite busy around Christmas time.
Stuart Nolman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nolman. And Book Banter looks at the life and career of old Ski Knows himself, Bob Hope, with Hope, Entertainer of the Century. So before you sing thanks for the memory, listen to my review coming up soon on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots and lots of stuff, and of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0286, was Scott Johnson, founder of the Frog Pants Studio Podcast Network. You can check out his site at frogpants.com. And thank you very much, Scott, for doing the guest Slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? 26-year-old Luis Moreno Jr. was pursued by police in Fort Lee, New Jersey, after he entered the carpool lane approaching the George Washington Bridge in January because he appeared to be alone in his SUV. After ignoring several signals to pull over, he finally stopped and, when informed of his offense, told the officer, "I have two passengers in the back," and rolled down a window to show them in the vehicle's third row. Apparently, that satisfied the officer. However, as Moreno pulled away, one passenger began screaming and banging on the back door. Moreno sped off with the hostages, yes, hostages, but was subsequently stopped again and charged with kidnapping and criminal restraint. But at least he wasn't charged with, you know, no carpool lane violation in this case. So, there you go. Now, this is someone who is a little unclear on the concept. Yes, Luis has people in his car, but if you're kidnapping them, the whole idea is to do it on the QT and not look like you have people in your car against their will. You know, some people apparently just will never learn. That's all I'm saying. Meanwhile, a police officer in Boynton Beach, Florida, had just parked his car in the police station parking lot when he noticed two men arguing in the street. One of the men spotted the officer and called over to him, "Hey, let me use your gun." He explained he needed to take care of someone who he says robbed him. About that time, another officer stepped out of the station. The man asked him, too, if he could use his gun. The two cops arrested the man, which caused him to say that he was going to get his own gun so that he could shoot the two officers. 38-year-old DeAndre Hall was charged with disorderly intoxication, possession of cocaine, and threatening a public servant. Yeah. DeAndre, repeat after me. "I could while away the hours, conferring with the flowers, consulting with the rain, and my head I'd be scratching while my thoughts were busy hatching if I only had a brain. Make that your mantra, DeAndre. Please. Please. Moving right along, Lolita Grayson had fake breasts and the man she's suing for divorce says a fake marriage. An alleged leak in the former has delayed a trial on the latter, though an attorney for her putative husband, Representative Alan Grayson, the Democrat from Florida, sounds like he suspects the medical emergency is fake too. Of course, if she has a true medical complication, we want her to take care of it, said Mark Najemi. But the timing, after her implants had been in for decades, is ironic. The congressman maintains that Lolita already had a husband when she married him. Meanwhile, a lawyer for the alleged bigamist wants to drop her too, citing legal infidelity. It's clear the wife has retained and/or paid other counsel to represent her in this case, said Mercedes Welcher. Other issues in this case include the wife, and I'm now doing air quotes here, accusing Alan Grayson of domestic violence, though video shows her pushing him, and her claiming that her house was leaking and he wasn't paying to fix it. He also, by the way, is spending $10,000 a month on her, including child support. Okay, so to recap, this story has leaky breasts, a leaky house, a woman with possibly more than one husband and probably more than one lawyer, the husband who's suing for divorce is a U.S. congressman who is paying $10,000 a month to his estranged wife, including child support. You know, this sounds like an episode of Dynasty. Remember Dynasty? Yeah, this is what this sounds like. And I'm willing to bet the congressman will probably get reelected in a snap, which has got to be one of the signs of the apocalypse. Anyway, we have time for one more Stuff File news story before we get to, at least in this segment anyway, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. And this is a couple of, shall we say, undignified deaths. Not quite the Darwin file, but undignified deaths nonetheless. And we have a couple of them, as I said. Police in Seville, Spain reported in November that a 23-year-old medical student visiting from Poland accidentally fell to her death at the famous Puente de Triana Bridge when she moved herself into position on the ledge to take a selfie. It was the third selfie death on the Iberian Peninsula in 5 months. In August, a tourist couple, both also from Poland, fell to their deaths while posting for a selfie at Cabo da Roca in Portugal. No comment on those because, quite frankly, it's just too easy. And undignified death story number two. In January, a tourist visiting the Spanish island of Ibiza with her boyfriend jumped up joyously as he proposed to her, lost her balance, and fell 65 feet off a cliff to her death. Well, you know, if your very last moment in life can't be a happy one, at least your second-to-last moment in life should be one. That's all I'm saying. Mission accomplished. Let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? February 15th is the 50th anniversary of one of the world's greatest flags, Canada's Maple Leaf. Rick Archbold is the author of A Flag for Canada, and he joins us on the line right now from Toronto. Hi, Rick.
Hi.
So this is a rather auspicious time for us Canadians who enjoy our Canadian flag. You know, it's interesting. I talk to younger people and they actually find it hard to believe that the flag is only 50 years old. It's so ingrained in our country.
And they also find it hard to believe that there was any fuss over it, which is interesting because it was accepted so quickly after all of the political battles that it's easy to forget that it, at the time, seemed like we might be breaking the country apart and that the flag was contributing, you know, the fight over the flag was contributing to that. It's amazing to think.
It's also interesting, I think, to note, not to wave too much of the flag in Pearson's direction, but the fact that he managed to get so much done, flag included, during two minority governments.
I know. It continues, I think, to stand out. And it was a period of only about 4 or 5 years that, you know, his two governments both lasted a little over 2 years, I think. So it's really extraordinary. I mean, the foundations of the of our so-called welfare state really date to that Pearson period.
I'm old enough, I think I'm a little younger than you, but I'm still old enough to remember the, you know, the Red Ensign when we were in school, and
yes,
and the first day that we actually got that flag and how proud everyone seemed to be. But as you say, it was a long and difficult journey to get there. One of the things I find just aghast is was it in, I believe, in Winnipeg, where the Prime Minister was booed by the military?
Yes, well, he was smart to go there. He knew it was going to be a difficult audience. It was the Royal Canadian Legion that he went to address. So these are all veterans who had fought in one of the two world wars, primarily, and in Korea. And they were all, or almost all, of the opinion that they had fought, in quotation marks, under the Red Ensign, which was the old flag. The Red Ensign being essentially the same flag as what Ontario has today. And so he was going into the lion's den and taking that case that he wanted to make for a new all-Canadian flag to that group of people. They were not very receptive at first. They did boo him. People stood up and waved Red Ensigns. There was a lot of stuff going on. And it looked for a time as if he might be shouted down. But in the end, I think there's a wonderful moment in that speech where the chairman tries to quiet the crowd, and Pearson turns to him and says, "Don't worry, Mr. Chairman. If you can't stand the heat, you have to get out of the kitchen." And everybody laughed and applauded. And from then on, people actually listened to what he was saying.
Amazing. Now, again, compromise had to take place. As I mentioned, it was minority governments at that time. So what role did John Diefenbaker and some of the others play in getting the flag that we now have?
I talked to a Tory who remembers back to that period about the flag debate, and he said something interesting. He said he thought that Diefenbaker had really let down the side, in a way, by fighting so hard against the new flag. He believed, and he was entitled to that belief, that the Canadian flag should retain the symbols of the old country, in this case Great Britain. And he was perfectly willing to have fleur-de-lis on the flag as well, as long as the Union Jack was there. But I think even many of the English-speaking members of his caucus disagreed with him or were willing to consider a new flag, and the Quebec caucus ultimately voted against him and for the flag when it came to a final vote.
Mm. Now, in doing research for the book, did you have any way of getting in contact or finding out information from people who were going through the debate at the time, who were against the flag, who, even though the flag is so beloved, still don't like it? Or did everyone eventually come around?
I think there are still you'll still find a few pockets of resistance. One spot where I got a kind of dismissive remark about the Maple Leaf flag was, interestingly enough, at the Diefenbaker Archives in Saskatoon. But you'd be hard-pressed to find a person today who doesn't just think that that's my flag and that's all there is to it. I do think occasionally maybe there are a few people. Well, I don't know if you ever have driven around Muskoka on Canada Day, but I'm sure I've seen an Ontario Red Ensign flying above a Maple Leaf flag. Maybe a slight political comment.
Now, you are a flag fan. You've written this book.
Yes.
But with all the information that you knew about the flag before, was there anything in doing your research that surprised you?
Yes. You would also probably agree with this, that when the new flag came forward, we didn't think of it as having a long history. We thought of it as being basically new, brand new. But what my research in the book revealed is that the maple leaf as a symbol of Canada goes back almost as far as we can go, all the way back to 1836, when, interestingly enough, the Saint-Jean-Baptiste Society incorporated it in their emblem and called for it to be the emblem of the Canadian people. And it was very shortly after that that in Ontario, what was then called Upper Canada, a whole group of people decided that they were going to wear maple leaves to show that they were native-born Canadians when Edward VII, then the Prince of Wales, came to visit Canada. So those are just two examples of how far back the leaf goes. And then, of course, what many people don't remember, particularly those of us who haven't studied World War One, the Canadian soldiers in World War One, who fought as part of the British Army, as part of the Imperial Army, all wore maple leaf cap badges and regimental insignia that had maple leaves designed into them, almost without exception. And they called themselves, and other people called them, maple leaves. That was their nickname. So really, start to look at the history as it unfolded, it becomes almost inevitable that the flag we have today came into being. I like to say, no one person designed the Canadian flag, although many people have claimed to be the designer. It was designed by the Canadian people.
Mm. Now,
over many, many years.
Now, through the process, the flag that we now enjoy and love so much came to be, but before we got to that point, there were some hideous alternatives out there, weren't there?
Well, some of them were grotesque, but there was one and some of them were just funny. They were obviously jokes. One was cross hockey sticks with two pucks, I believe, and, there's one that has a scantily clad woman who looks an awful lot like Marilyn Monroe. I guess she's supposed to be Miss Canada. It's pretty funny when you look at them now. But they're the serious designs, and there were many good ones, almost all of them did include a maple leaf. That's another sort of bit of evidence as to where the decision was inevitably going to head. There were a few neat alternatives. Like there's a beautiful flag, which I think we reproduce in the book, that represents the Northern Lights, for example. But 99 times out of 100, somewhere on that flag, you're going to find a maple leaf, if not as the central symbol, then one of the symbols.
Was there a runner-up? I mean, we know what we have today, but were there some others that were close in the running?
Well, there were three finalists when the flag committee came to choose and recommend something to Parliament. One of the three finalists was what was known as the Pearson Pennant, which was the flag that he originally proposed back in June of 1964 when he opened the flag debate. This was, those of us who were around them will remember seeing these flying from car aerials. There were two blue bars with three red maple leaves in the middle. It was a pretty flag, but there was no way that the Tories were going to vote for a flag that was Pearson's favorite. So he relinquished that quite easily when the time came and said, fine, go with the single leaf, which, of course, turns out to be a better design.
Absolutely.
Much better design.
And very quickly, one of the sad notes I find in all of this is that I understand that the very first flag that was flown on top of Parliament Hill, no one knows where it is.
Well, as far as I can tell, it has gone missing. A number of people have claimed that they have it, but they don't. We just really don't know what happened to it. The flag that was flying from the Peace Tower that morning was actually the Governor General's flag, because whenever the Governor General is on Parliament Hill, the Governor General's standard has to fly from the Peace Tower. So where is the flag? That flag? I don't know. And where, interestingly enough, there were several prototypes. The very first maple leaf flag with its current specifications that was silk screened one night at the Canadian Museums Corporation has disappeared. There's only one left of the three that were originally silkscreened, and I'd love to know what's happened to them.
Mm. Well, it's a fascinating topic and a great anniversary with a lot of pride for lots of people, February 15th being the 50th anniversary of the Canadian flag. The book is called A Flag for Canada. People, I understand, can get more information by going to your website, flagforcanada.ca, correct?
That's correct.
Rick, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
My pleasure.
Rick Archbold, author of A Flag for Canada. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0286, and you'll find links to Rick's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from Canada, the land of universal healthcare, colorful money, and the correct spelling of the word theater. This is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to artist Mark O'Connell. Plus, Stuart Nauman is in with another edition of Book Banter. And we have lots more Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. Stick around for that. Here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get right back to the stuff, okay? We have had a spate of stories over the last little while where it seems to be that many schools are filled with administrators who are just complete morons. And this is the latest example of it. Jason Stewart of Kermit, Texas, took his family to see The Hobbit, The Battle of the Five Armies. A few days later, his 9-year-old son, Aiden, took a Hobbit ring to Kermit Elementary School. Aiden told another boy of the ring's magical powers. If he put it on the other boy's head, he'd disappear. That's not harmless fantasy, school officials declared. Aiden was suspended from fourth grade for making a terrorist threat. Yes, it was Aiden's third suspension in 6 months. The first was because he observed a fellow's skin was black and said so. It's an observation. It's not a crime. Speaking as a black person, I know that. But anyway, the second was because he brought his favorite book to school to impress his teacher. But the big book of knowledge includes a section on pregnancy, including a photo of a pregnant woman. Wow. Principal Roxine Greer refused to comment on any of it, saying, "You know, all student stuff is confidential." Stewart said Aiden lacks the magical powers necessary to threaten his friend's existence. If he did, I'm sure he'd bring him right back. You know, Aiden doesn't have magical powers, but the voters in the district have the magical power necessary to make the school board disappear if they don't fix this. I mean, these pinheads at the school must be the direct descendants of the folks who back in the day would roam the village with pitchforks and torches. This is just asinine. Completely asinine. Anyway, moving right along. According to a Pasco County, Florida Sheriff's Office arrest report, 50-year-old John Balmer was in line at a Kmart store when a deputy came in. Balmer saw the deputy and allegedly tried to hand a bag of green leafy substance to a person behind him who refused to take it. Balmer put the bag on the floor and went on to pay. When another deputy approached, store workers told him about the bag. Balmer was arrested but declined to speak. His shirt, however, spoke on his behalf. "Who needs drugs?" the black T-shirt read. Below that it said, No, seriously, I have drugs. He was charged with marijuana and methamphetamine possession. And who says there's no truth in advertising these days, huh? Yeah. UPS officials said they have fired a seasonal driver recorded by Houston security cameras throwing packages over a fence and urinating on a home. Ben Lucas said he checked his surveillance cameras after arriving home January 8th to find his packages, 22 caliber ammunition, chemicals, and a machine for cleaning gun parts, were on the inside of his locked fence and appeared to have been damaged. Lucas said the video, which he later posted on YouTube, showed the UPS driver throw the packages over the locked fence before unzipping his fly and urinating on his home. So basically, I paid someone to come to my house and pee on it, Lucas said. Lucas said he posted the video to UPS's Facebook page when officials seemed unwilling to watch it or give him an apology. He said the move led to a phone call from a UPS supervisor. She was apologetic and wants to send me a "we're sorry" gift. That's what I kind of wanted. I just wanted someone to say, yeah, he shouldn't have done that. We'll try to make sure that doesn't happen again. UPS issued a statement saying the driver, a seasonal employee, was fired. UPS is dismayed by actions that violated decency and delivery care. The local management team did take action to terminate the individual. However, they were wrong if they did not clarify this resolution with Mr. Lucas at the time. UPS sincerely apologizes to our customer. No behavior like that is acceptable. Isn't that a nice statement? Yeah. Okay, let's back up a second here. Now, we understand that the former employee was not diligent in his duties, but when you think about it, he was also not very bright. Okay, think this thing through for a second. Drivers usually have an idea of what the package is that they're trying to deliver, right? So this guy was delivering ammunition, chemicals, and a machine for cleaning gun parts. Is this the kind of customer that you want to piss off, or for that matter, piss on their house? I don't know. That's dangerously close to idiot of the day territory, my friend. Dangerously close. Which reminds me, we do have an idiot of the day coming up a little later on in the program. Stick around for that. Time for one more story in the Stuff File News section, in this Stuff File News section, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A miles-long traffic jam on Interstate 20 near Tuscaloosa, Alabama on January 25th was caused by an 18-wheeler that jackknifed and overturned when the 57-year-old driver took his hands off the wheel to pull out a tooth with his fingers. What, you need both hands for that? Efforts to haul his truck from the roadside required an hours-long detour of traffic off the interstate. The driver's mission was successful, by the way. You'd be glad to know. He had the tooth in his pocket when he was rescued. Wow. If I tried to write that into a script for, say, BJ and the Bear back in the 70s, no one would believe such a harebrained plotline. No one. Yet it happened. Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Mark O'Connell is an artist in the UK, but to use just the word artist is a bit simplistic. He's also an animator, director, film reviewer, and video games PR guru, just to name a few. Mark joins us on the line right now via Skype-to-Skype communications from the UK. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So how did you end up with all these hyphens?
Okay, so I've always loved animation and art and all that kind of thing. That was always kind of a dream to me. So I studied art and then went on to do it at university and was working on my own projects. But then, of course, I've always been interested in games and films as well. So naturally sort of pursued my hobbies at a career level. So I've worked in the games industry. I've worked in film, being a film reviewer as well. So I like to keep myself busy and entertained.
With the exception of film reviewing, do all of your hobbies kind of dovetail through the world of art to a certain degree?
Absolutely. I really enjoy art, media, and, you know, creative things, things I can feed back into as well.
Now, one of the things you also do is caricatures, right?
Yeah, that's right. So I've always enjoyed in my spare time, even from when I was very little, just, you know, looking at someone maybe on TV or someone eating a sandwich somewhere and, you know, just drawing them and coming up with my interpretation of what they might look like. And so I've continued that through now, and I get commissioned to do caricatures for people's weddings or family portraits, all that kind of thing. So I get quite busy around Christmas time.
People can take a look at your work. They can find it at the website at markoconnell.com. But how would you describe your style when it comes to doing caricatures?
Well, some caricatures can be quite mean. I always try and bring out the best in people if I can. Of course, if I was doing something for someone's wedding, I don't want the gift to make them cry. So I would say a kind of hyper-real, sort of over-the-top but friendly interpretation of them.
And you've actually had the opportunity to do some caricatures of famous people. As a matter of fact, weren't you recently commissioned to do some?
Yeah, that's right. So there's quite a famous comedian in the UK called Jack D, and I was invited onto one of his comedy shows, and he asked me to do a caricature of him for that. Through that, I also met a brilliant Canadian comedian called Catherine Ryan, who I've since done a caricature of her and her entire family.
So how did you get the invite for this television appearance in the first place?
Well, so I kind of hear about different productions going on and all that kind of thing. And it was actually, the show was called Don't Sit in the Front Row. And the idea was that, you know, when you go to a comedy club and they say never sit in the front row because you're always going to be a target of comedians. Well, this show would have three or four comedians and actually purposely target a few people in the front row. So that sounded like a fun idea to me. So I went along as a contestant. And of course, when they were learning a bit more about me, they invited me to actually do a caricature of the host of the show, Jack D.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
Yeah, it was a great opportunity and another way of, you know, getting my work out there to a wider audience.
Now, you were also a film reviewer for a while on a radio station in the UK. How did that come about? And I also want to talk a little bit about your website, your other site, which is film... -reviews.net. So how did that all come about?
Yeah, so that really started, I set that up in 2003, purely just in my spare time to share my love of movies. I see pretty much every film that comes out. And so I naturally just started writing about them. And then the website got quite popular. I started getting invited to press screenings, film premieres, interviews and all that kind of thing. And from there, I've really sort of kept that going no matter what job I've had. So now I also get invited to write for various magazines. As you mentioned, I was on the radio for over a year and a half for a station called Rock FM in the UK. So I love films and games and, you know, sharing my passion with other people.
So tell me, as someone who's involved in, who loves films and has an opportunity to review them, and we'll get to the games in a minute, but how have movies, games... how have they in any way, shape, or form affected your artwork?
Oh, well, in tons of ways. So films, for example, they're very cinematic, they're very stylized, just looking, not even the storyline, but, you know, the lighting, how the characters look. If you look at a DreamWorks animation compared to Disney or anime and all that kind of thing, all very different styles. So I love studying the artists and, you know, the process behind how they make them. And the same is very true with games as well.
So what is your connection to games? Tell us about that. You work with the game industry.
So that that really started through my film website. I started reviewing games as well. I was then invited to a THQ press event and got interviewing a creative director there from Los Angeles. He kind of liked some of my ideas, so eventually invited me to work in LA, which I did for about a year and a half on THQ's WWE wrestling games. So that's really how I got into the games industry.
Now, did you ever think of yourself when you were growing up, probably doodling and drawing, that all of your artwork and these ideas would lead you at some point to California?
Not at all. I mean, I've always dreamed of going to California, but maybe through a film route. But, you know, in my spare time when I wasn't drawing or watching films, I was playing games. So I was inadvertently training myself for this other career.
With your work as an animator and an artist, do you see yourself someday perhaps working on the creation of video games?
Well, at the moment, I'm kind of working in marketing department at Microsoft's Lift London studio. But sort of independently, I've been working on a short animated cartoon myself, which is 2D. It's going to be 3 minutes long and approximately 4,500 drawings.
Wow. This is the way that a lot of animators have started. Do you ever envision yourself at some point perhaps making an animated feature film or being part of an animated feature film?
Yeah, well, you know, this cartoon I'm doing really could be the first step towards that. I mean, my dream is, of course, to run my own animated studio. So once this is complete, I plan to take it to animation festivals around the world. Because of my experience in film and games, I've also learned how to do marketing and presentations, and I've also built up quite a network myself. So hopefully that will all help me realize my dreams of animation.
Do you have a timetable for this, or when the general population out there can see more of your work on a greater scale?
Oh boy, so I continue to do caricatures and things like that all the time, so stay tuned to my website and also film and game related stuff. But I imagine it will take probably a good year to complete the cartoon. So just to let you know how far I've progressed, I've written the script, I've storyboarded it, I've done all the backgrounds, I've cast all the characters and recorded the dialogue, and I've probably done about 300 frames of animation so far.
Wow. Okay, so you're progressing at a pretty good clip there. Although, just like glaciers, making animation does move at a very slow pace, doesn't it?
Absolutely, it really does. And plus, as I say, I'm working full-time at Microsoft in the evenings. I'm often at film screenings, so I'll spend the night writing reviews and features and all that kind of stuff. So I grab every spare moment I can to continue working on this passion project of mine.
And in the world of games, I know you have a connection, as you say, to Microsoft, but beyond that, what are some of the games that catch your eye? What do you like to play?
I really like an assortment, from things like Call of Duty or Uncharted to even SingStar, the karaoke game I really enjoy. I've got a four-year-old daughter now, so I'm introducing her to things like Super Mario and more simplistic platform games that we can both play together. But I really enjoy all sorts, from sporting to, you know, adventure, role-play games, the whole lot. I just really enjoy quality narratives and gameplay mechanics.
And besides the game playing itself, as the artist within you, what games make you visually go, wow?
Okay, so there's been a few, I think, over the years. I mean, the first one that really blew my mind, I think, was in 1997. That was Final Fantasy VII on the PlayStation 1. At the time, there was nothing graphically to compare to it. More recently, I'd say games such as Uncharted looked phenomenal, and also the most recent Tomb Raider. So they are really great examples of, you know, how far games have gone, and even the latest Assassin's Creed Unity looks phenomenal.
Excellent. Well, again, people can find out more information by going to your website, which is markoconnell.com, and they can see some of your work, both the work you do in reviewing and also the work you do as an artist. Mark, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter. It's been fantastic. I love your show, so thank you for inviting me on it.
Artist Mark O'Connell. You can check out his website at markoconnell.com. And, of course, you can go to my website. You'll find the link there at thestufffile.com. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. 206 years ago this week, one of the most respected leaders our nation has ever known was born. His name? Abraham Lincoln. While most of us remember Lincoln as one of our greatest presidents, many believe he was also one of the wisest lawyers ever to practice law in America, too. Oh, he lost his share of cases, but his high ideals and his refusal to sue another person unless it was a last resort earned him great respect. Listen to what he said to his fellow lawyers on the topic of suing another person, and I quote, "Discourage litigation. Persuade your neighbors to compromise whenever you can. Point out to them how the nominal winner is often a real loser, in fees, expenses, and waste of time." End of quote. What wonderful advice. Now let's be fair. Lincoln knew that people will have disputes from time to time, and sometimes lawsuits are necessary. But he also believed that there are better ways of resolving disputes than in court. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, Stuart is here once again with another edition of Book Banter. Hello, Stu.
Hi, Peter. And boy, if you read To Kill a Mockingbird, you're going to be you were a happy camper recently.
Oh, I already know about this. Yes. A sequel. What, 50 years in the making?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, good things come to those who wait. And coming this summer, the sequel to Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee's coming up. It's going to be the hottest selling book of the year. You have to admit that.
Absolutely. You know, it's interesting. The woman only wrote one book. Yeah. And now 50 years later, she's writing a second book. But when you think about it, yeah, the synopsis of this book that I've seen seems to be very similar to what her original plan was for this book, except that her publisher changed the direction.
Yeah, well, God bless that publisher, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
No, I'm looking forward to reading this book when it comes out in the summer. So, this is my Felix prediction. This is going to be the biggest selling book of the year. It certainly will be.
How soon do you think somebody will want to make a movie?
Oh, I wouldn't be surprised if they snatch those film rights, sooner than that. Hmm.
Anyway, the To Kill a Mockingbird was a movie that was made in old Hollywood, and I understand you're talking about somebody else who was definitely old Hollywood.
Oh, yes, definitely. Let me tell you about something about Bob Hope. Because at the time of his peak period from the late 40s to early 70s, Hope was a virtual entertainment runaway train. Get a load of this, Peter. He had a weekly radio program on NBC. He did a monthly specials for NBC television. He appeared in at least two pictures a year for Paramount. He did a string of personal shows and appearances across North America. He was a near perennial Academy Awards host, wrote a series of best-selling books, and every Christmas time took an entourage of writers, musicians, and entertainers to U.S. Army and Air Force bases around the globe to do a series of morale-boosting shows for the troops. And you know what? I thought James Brown was the hardest-working man in show business.
You forgot one other point, too.
What's that?
Buying up all of California.
Oh, yeah. He owned a lot of land by the time he died at the age of 100.
Yeah, yeah.
A lot of it. I think he could have, been the king of Palm Springs, for all we know.
Certainly a potentate of some kind.
Yeah, that's for sure. And you know what? Richard Zoglin, who wrote an excellent book about comedy, in the 70s called Comedy on the Edge, excellent book. He's now written a very absorbing, revealing biography of Bob Hope called Hope, Entertainer of the Year. Now, Zoglin, who's a theater critic for Time magazine, his chief argument in the book is that Bob Hope worked his way up to transforming himself from a run-of-the-mill vaudeville comedian to a comedian as mega-celebrity. He developed practices that stand-up comics to this day use, such as writing and delivering topical, relevant jokes, making the comedian as a brand, and utilizing endless self-promotion on electronic and print media to promote upcoming live shows, movies, and television specials.
Yeah, could you imagine Bob Hope in the day of Twitter and Facebook? Wow.
You know what? He would have used that to the hilt.
Yeah, absolutely.
He really would have. But you know what? This all came beside all his fame, it came a rather dark and savory side to Bob Hope, and it comes out in all of its gory detail glory in this book. Like, for example, Hope's staff of writers through the years basically worked for Bob Hope 24/7, and at times wrote jokes for him at a whim, no matter what time of day or occasion it was. They even had to write jokes when he was just playing golf with three U.S. Army generals. Then his reliance on scripts and cue cards never left Hope any room for spontaneity when he performed on TV and radio. He was quite frugal. In fact, he paid his writers, one of them was Larry Gelbart, the other was Sherwood Schwartz, he they folded their paychecks into paper airplanes and threw them from the top of a staircase. Then his pro-Vietnam War stance during the 60s forever alienated him from the younger generation of performers in comics, even though his specials were huge rating successes. And although they appeared as the best of friends in their Seven Road pictures, Bob Hope and Bing Crosby at best never got along with each other off camera. In fact, in the late 70s, Hope admitted to a production assistant that he never liked Bing Crosby and thought he was a real SOB. And I'm being very polite about this.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, you know, you mentioned the dark side of Bob Hope, and everybody has their dark sides, but you tossed another name out there, Sherwood Schwartz, who, as you know, is somebody that I've both chatted with and worked with because we did the shows at Just for Laughs together with Sherwood Schwartz. And in talking backstage with Sherwood Schwartz, and he talked a lot, I got to say, he was a joy to be around. The one thing that caught my attention was Sherwood Schwartz never really had a bad thing to say about anybody, including Bob Hope. But he had a lot of bad things to say about Red Skelton.
Oh, really?
Another person he wrote for.
And probably, and I don't forget, Skelton was on TV for over 20 years.
Yep, exactly.
And you know what? Maybe Richard Zoglin should pay attention to him. But speaking of Zoglin, he has delivered a fascinating behind the laughter, warts and all look at the cold, hard reality of what made Bob Hope an entertainment legend. And although his contributions have been wide and varied, his self-centered, cold, private persona has been brought out in this book to devastating effect, and as a result has taken off a great deal of the luster to the Bob Hope mystique. And what the sad thing is especially after reading this book, is that although many of today's stand-up comedians should thank Bob Hope for what he has brought to the comedy world that he practiced today, his unwavering set-in-his-ways manner has reduced him to a rather arcane comedy dinosaur. And it kind of makes you wonder what other legendary comedians will be subject to the Zoglin biographical treatment. Maybe Red Skelton will be one of them.
Well, you know, I haven't read the book. Obviously, you have. Yes. But I'm going to defend Bob to a certain degree. And that is, no one gets to be, no matter how nice you are, no one gets to be as powerful and at the top of the food chain of entertainment without ruffling a few feathers from some people who don't like them one way or the other.
No, I understand that. And so, you get that with any, you know, comedian, performer, anyone at a high, you know, level of, you know, whether even a CEO for that matter. So, yeah, I mean, no one's immune to that. But,
you know, there's got to be, it's hard as it may be to believe, there's got to be somebody in Hollywood who doesn't like Betty White.
we won't find that for a while.
So it's just the way it is. Not everybody is going to be liked by everyone they have to deal with, because sometimes you have to be a little bit harsh with people who are SOBs themselves.
Oh, exactly.
And the people who are SOBs themselves never see themselves as being one.
They'll be the last to tell you that.
Exactly. Anyway, so the book is called
Hope, Entertainer of the Century by Richard Zoglin. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $36.
And what is some of the other recommended reading in this genre that you suggest, sir?
Well, I figured let's go recommend some of the books that I read by Bob Hope himself. So I have like four quick recommendations. There's his 1963 best-selling memoir, I Owe Russia $1,200, about his world travels in the late 50s, early 60s. Half Tucks Will Travel, which was his autobiography, which was published in 1954. Don't Shoot, It's Only Me, which was published in the early 90s, about his time traveling around the world, entertaining the troops. And also The Road to Hollywood, which was published in the 1980s, which is basically an overlook of his movie career, of all of his movies. And a lot of these books aren't in print anymore. So the best thing to do, go to your secondhand bookstore, always available. If not, there's always eBay.
Excellent. And again, this week's book is
Hope, Entertaining the Century by Richard Zoglin. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $36.
And how can people find you, sir?
Well, before you, in paper and the Montreal Times every week, published every Saturday, or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, sir.
Yes, and now I'm off on the road to Morocco.
Stuart Nelman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about out of racetrack for this edition of the Stuff File program. I have a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you before we get to our idiot of the day. Authorities in North Carolina say they have rearrested a prison inmate who escaped from the facility by putting on a coat and walking out the front door. The Brunswick County Sheriff's Office said William Earl Hewitt was found hiding in a camper on his family's property 5 days after his escape from the Brunswick County Prison. Hewitt escaped from the prison by donning a coat and posing as his brother Curtis Hewitt, who was due to be released that day. Security camera footage from the incident shows Hewitt walk through a metal detector before being pursued by a jailer. Footage taken outside the facility shows Hewitt shed the coat and outran the jail worker to make his escape. Hewitt was charged with escaping from a county or municipal facility. He was also serving outstanding warrants on charges of burning property and property damage. Hewitt was ordered held in lieu of $3 million bond. The sheriff's office said five others, including Hewitt's mother, stepfather, and girlfriend, were arrested on allegations of helping to hide the suspect from authorities. Curtis Hewitt is also facing charges for helping his brother escape. Brunswick County Sheriff John Ingram blamed human error for Hewitt's escape and said one person has been fired as a result of the probe, which is ongoing. Okay. This seems to be a really classy, upstanding family, doesn't it? What I don't understand is how his brother Curtis, who was slated to be released that day, went along with this harebrained ruse to let his brother, William Earl, leave as him. Well, hopefully they can all be in jail together now, I guess. Meanwhile, Mike Montemayor, until recently a county commissioner in Laredo, Texas, pleaded guilty to bribery charges in June and had argued in January of this year that he should get a light sentence because, after all, he had subsequently helped FBI agents in a sting against three other officials accused of bribery. However, the prosecutor immediately countered that Montemayor had in fact tried to steal the recording devices and Apple computer that the FBI had furnished him to do the undercover work. He got 6 years in prison and a $109,000 fine. Oh, so you mean the stuff from the FBI was only on loan? So I guess you're saying there were no lovely parting gifts for his help? I mean, I just want to clarify. I'm just checking, you know? Maybe that's something he should have done before he tried to steal all that stuff, but I digress. Meanwhile, in October, vandals in Paris destroyed the large inflatable tree by U.S. artist Paul McCarthy in the city's Place Vendôme Square, but not before it became widely characterized as a giant green plug of the type used for anal sexual stimulation. Paris's news website, The Local, reported in December that the controversy had been a boon to the city's sex shops. "We used to sell about 50 plugs a month," said one wholesaler. "Since the controversy, we've moved more than 1,000 at the equivalent of $23 to $45 in materials ranging from glass to stainless steel to silicone." Well, sometimes the power of suggestion is a little freaky, I guess. Anyway, we have hit the end of the program. Before we do say goodbye, you know what time it is, folks. Yes, once again, it's time now for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
A man in Southwest Florida was arrested for multiple felony counts, listed drug dealer as his occupation on his arrest report. 25-year-old Robert Michael Phillips was apprehended after he cut off an unmarked Palm Beach County Sheriff's car while riding in a stolen vehicle. Yes, because they're always in stolen vehicles. Wow. Authorities trailed Phillips, watching him engage in a drug transaction before he fled from marked patrol cars. Deputies say Phillips left his vehicle at one point, cutting through a hobby store where he barreled into a woman and dropped a loaded handgun. Authorities deployed a police dog and caught Phillips as he ran from the store's back exit. Phillips was in possession of crack cocaine, heroin, a weighing scale, hypodermic needles, and $2,316 in cash. Records show that he had been arrested over a dozen times and was convicted 7 times on felony counts, including a slew of weapons violations and drug possession charges, serving nearly 9 months in prison between 2011 and 2012. Okay, this one is a little bit more ambiguous as to who is the idiot here. I mean, why would someone actually list their occupation as being a drug dealer on an arrest report? Then again, if you've been convicted 7 times on felony counts, proving that you're an habitual criminal, but you've only served less than 9 months behind bars, well, that proves that either you, the Florida justice system, or both are idiots!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0286. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0286. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Any rebroadcast of this copywritten program in whole or in part without the express written consent of, oh God, who the hell are we kidding? Who's going to steal this show? God, who writes this stuff? Holder, what a kidder.